Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. I'm a big believer that the harder conversations, the ones that aren't about the happy, shiny things, but about darker, more difficult parts of our life, are the most rewarding. Being honest about when life seems to fall apart often not only helps us, but others. My guest today is one of those brave people who's not afraid to have these kind of conversations. After her son Gray died when he was just 21 days old, Georgina Lucas wrote a book, If Not For You, about his short life and the profound impact it had on her. And while on the one hand it's incredibly sad, the story of his life is actually incredibly beautiful, because I believe it's possible to do awful things well, and Georgina and Gray's story is just that. Georgina, thank you so much for coming along today. I was so moved by your book, because it was just such a beautiful story of a tragic story, but so beautifully written for a start. But, you know, certainly the sort of generosity and support you had from the people in the NICU and the people surrounding you was just amazing. Amazing story of human kindness.
Yeah, I think that is definitely one of the big things I take away from it. There's all sorts of things, but the NICU staff were absolutely incredible. And I think I say in the book, you know, the worst of times show you the best of people and the best people. And I really believe that they really made the darkest days light-filled, which sounds so contradictory. And I think one of the things I found difficult afterwards was people saying, it's such a tragedy. Everything about it is such a tragedy, because obviously it was a tragedy. It's horrendous. He is dead. He's not here. But there were so many moments of beauty through his life and of joy. And it taught me so much about life and about the kindness that hides in, you know, the most unexpected places, and the joy and the laughter that you find amongst the most awful things. You know, I remember after Gray died, Mike was changing his nappy to get him ready to be taken away, and he weed, and we all just burst out laughing. And it felt so strange, because there was our little tiny baby boy who was dead, but we were laughing and laughing with the nurse. And I think it's very strange, because before I always thought very much that sad things were sad and kind of happy things were happy, and sometimes there were intersections, but really you can kind of box things up, and actually you can't. And I think you know, the kindness and joy in those days is kind of some of the purest joy that I've ever really felt and had. And yeah, it was a lot about the staff and how they just went above and beyond all the time, you know, as well as looking after him and having this incredible medical knowledge. They were just so compassionate and so kind to us always.
I mean, there's so much. We've come out of a pandemic, and obviously this all happened at the beginning, in the middle of, well, just before the pandemic.
Before the pandemic, yeah.
And obviously during the pandemic, it was all about, you know, the amazing NHS staff. But I feel since it feels like the NHS are falling apart a bit, and there's lots in the news about how useless it is and people waiting ages for operations. But I'm reading your book, it really struck me that we've become so much better at supporting parents and children in these awful situations. I remember reading the autobiography of the Dowager Duchess of Devonshire, Deborah Mitford, and she had, I think, two or three children who were stillborn or died very shortly after birth. And she describes, and so this would have been in the 50s or the 60s. Yeah. She gave birth at sort of 32 weeks and the baby was taken away, and about an hour later the doctor came in to check her and she said, you know, what about my baby? And he looked at her and went, we don't think he survived, do you? You know, this is 50 years ago, 60 years ago, maybe a bit longer, my maths is terrible, but we've come such a long way, and for that I'm so grateful. I mean, it was certainly my experience of losing a baby wasn't anything like yours, and that's partly because it happened in a different country, but also partly because, you know, I think in the UK we are slightly ahead of the game.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely heartbreaking and horrendous to imagine that in, you know, fairly recent history, that was how women were being treated, the Dowager Duchess, and then you as well. And I think I've been contacted by people since writing the book, actually, interestingly, quite a few fathers, saying, you know, I remember one saying really honestly, I feel some envy at the way that your experience was, because he remembers being handed a clipboard and just asked really curtly, you know, buried or cremated. And you think, that's someone's child. That's their baby. And unfortunately and sadly, I think even now our experience is not universal. I don't think people have that same treatment wherever they go. And one of the reasons I want people to read the book is because I think it makes such a difference. It really makes such a difference how you're treated in those times, how you are then able to frame that experience in your life. It doesn't make it any less horrendous. It hasn't been an easy journey since Grey died, but knowing how beautifully and compassionately we were treated while he lived and in his death, I think helped us so much that it wasn't an added layer of trauma that we had to deal with. You know, everything about the way they treated him was as a human being, which is what he was, you know, which is what the Dowager Duchess's babies were. And it was breaking my heart recently seeing on the news, you know, women who haven't known where their babies have been buried. And I saw a woman recently who her local councillor had found where her baby boy was buried, and she was in her 80s going to see him for the first time, and, you know, just sitting next to this resting place and saying kind of, mummy's here. And she said she felt a peace that she kind of had been searching for her whole, you know, since he'd been born and he was dead. And I think it's so important to remember that, and to know that the love that you have for your child, for your baby, is, you know, it's the same as your other children. I love Grey just as much as I love Finn and Bear, my other children, and the shortness of their life has no impact on that. You know, you don't think, oh well, he only lived for 3 weeks, so, you know, I'll get over that. There's less love, is there? You know, like you with Willem, you don't think, oh, after a bit of time goes by, we'll forget about him. You don't, do you? They're part of your family, you know, albeit in a way that no one would ever want, but they are. And, you know, I really always think that the way the doctors and nurses validated that and validated our feelings was just completely critical. You know, we had the odd time, I had the odd conversation. I was reminded about scans a couple of times after Grey had died, and had not that compassionate conversations with people. And it gives you such a jolt. And I have an incredible support system. I have a wonderful husband, a wonderful family, amazing friends. And you're so vulnerable in those moments that the way you're treated, I think, has a huge impact on how you're dealing with it, on how you process it longer term. And it's so important for everybody to know that, and to know that you need to support people and be there for people, and not, you know, not think, oh well, you know, you didn't know them, or they only lived for a week or a few weeks, so it doesn't matter. That's, you know, it's just not true. That's not how it is. So yeah, I think I feel so lucky that we had that experience, and that I think, you know, people like you speaking about your experience, I know, has hugely shaped the way as a society we view this, so that when this came to happen to us and Grey died, which was 2.5 years ago, the world has moved on and hopefully continues to move on, and these conversations continue to be happen, because sadly, babies are not going to stop dying, much as I wish they would. I wish we had been the last ones. Every person I speak to who's lost a baby afterwards, I have that jolt of thinking, oh my God, how, you know, you feel, how is this still happening? But it is. And while we work out how to make it not happen, I think the most important thing is for people to know and understand a little bit about how you can support someone who goes through it.
Yeah, I mean, it's that continuing of a conversation. For me, it was, you know, the conversation that I've sort of initiated has helped me massively, because, you know, as you mentioned, that idea that you love that child and that child will always be a part of you. And it's almost more hurtful when people don't want to talk about that child, this kind of notion that because they didn't live, they don't count, which so often we slightly get fed back into. I mean, one of the things I always struggle with is when people say, how many children do you have? And more often than not, I'll say there are two. But I have three children.
Yeah.
You know, you have three children.
Yeah.
And it's, that's like one of the things I feel so difficult, you know, so conflicted about.
Yeah. It's such, I find it so difficult. I find at the moment, because Finn, my son, is just turned four, and then Grey is in the middle, he would be 2.5, and then Bear has just turned one. And I refer to Finn and Bear whenever I can as my oldest and my youngest, because it avoids me saying my boys or my two boys, because it's exactly that conflict of, in many situations, you don't necessarily want to say, actually, I have three children, one of them is dead. There's not the time, it's not the place to go into it. And also often you're fearful of the way someone is going to respond to that. And I know that sometimes I say it quite flippantly because I think, you know, it's a defense mechanism, and then people don't necessarily respond how you want them to and don't give him the space that you want them to. But it's incredibly difficult, and I hate that question. And I think because Grey died 3 months before the pandemic, and then we went into the pandemic and we didn't see people for a long time, and we weren't going to kind of children's birthday parties and those kind of things. And I remember one of the first ones we went to afterwards, and I had this, you know, I think I thought quite a lot of time had passed and we could go and could almost just be normal parents, and walked in, and obviously, you know, inevitably one of the first questions someone says is kind of, so how many children, you know, do you have and which one is yours? And you have that moment, don't you, of thinking, do I say two and they're those two, or do I say three? And then at this lovely first birthday party, I've got to drop this bombshell into the room of telling you that I have another son and he's dead and he died when he was 3 weeks old. And it's such a difficult conversation to have. And it's, you know, it's so joyful to me when people do engage in that conversation. And we were at a barbecue recently and this lovely girl just started talking to me about him and asking me, and she didn't seem shocked, she didn't seem kind of horrified that I'd mentioned him. She said, I'm so sorry. And then she said, you know, when was it and how old would he be and what's his name? And it's so lovely to be able to talk about him. And I think one of the things that I feel so lucky with the book is that I get to have conversations about him, and I get to talk about him, you know, with you and say his name, because I think day to day you often don't get to, do you? As you say, you know, you end up saying, oh, I've got two. And that's such a difficult thing, because one thing I always really think about, depending on who I'm talking to, is if I say I have two children and then later on you learn about Grey, do you then think, because I said I had two, that somehow I place less relevance on him? And actually the reason I said two is to avoid, you know, an awkward conversation with you. It's no reflection at all of how I feel about him. But there are so many layers of complexity about it, aren't there? I think, you know, and I don't know, I remember a close school friend of mine coming over shortly after Grey had died and Mike, my husband, was out, and I remember her sitting at the kitchen table and just firing questions at me about him and about his birth and his life. And it was so lovely, and you know, all those things like, how much did he weigh and kind of, and what did he look like and what was his hair like and all these things. And she said, you know, please tell me if you ever don't want to answer any of these questions. And I said, I do, I want to, you know, it's so sad. It's so sad that he's not here. It will always be devastating. And as, you know, we've talked about, there are every day almost, there are new things that are sad that he's missed and we've missed. But, you know, being able to talk about him and talk about him just normally and smiling as one of my children is really joyful to me. And I think it's a hard thing to explain, isn't it? That's how important that is and how much joy that brings you as a mother, as a parent, I think.
I think for people listening who haven't experienced the loss of a child, I'd say that's the one really important thing for people to know, that it is really important. It's not just okay to mention their name. It's really important.
Yeah.
I remember one year on Willem's birthday, I was with my family and everyone forgot. And listen, it was like 5 years in or 4 years in. So it was, yeah, I get it. But I got so upset and they were like, oh, we're so sorry. I was like, you forget the things that don't matter. And he mattered.
Yeah.
And he matters still hugely to me. And I think that, you know, is so important, especially as time goes on. Because obviously without a sort of presence in life, it is easier to forget, especially if you're not the person that held them or gave birth to them.
Exactly, and you never met them. And
It's really, really, it's like... So probably at the stage that I'm at now, it will be 8 years this summer since he died. And I think it's little throwaway comments. Like I was talking with my sisters, or we were talking with someone else about the amount of children. We've all got two living children. But Chiara, my sister, said, oh, well, maybe if Marina had had three, we probably would have had three. And the point she was making is that you sort of follow the leader. But I sort of wanted to say I did have three.
Yeah.
And it's little comments like that sometimes you think...
Yeah. I remember a friend of mine saying, you know, friend of a friend, saying how's the transition after Bear was born? How's the transition been from one to two? And I just went, I didn't know what to say because I thought... Well, in my head, what's happened is I've gone from one to two to kind of back to one and then one who's here, but he's not here. And then when Bear was born, I had this confusing, I've now got two at home, but I've got three. So it's much more confusing and much more complicated than a transition from one to two. It's a completely different thing. And of course, he didn't mean anything by it. And in many ways, you know, it was a lovely, thoughtful thing to say because Bear was small. And it is it's always a transition, but it's just when one of your children is dead, everything becomes so much more complicated, doesn't it? I think every conversation, every question becomes very loaded. One of the things that I always find so difficult is, you know, sometimes that comment that people say about kind of, oh, we kept them alive for a year on their child's first birthday. And, you know, it's in many ways a kind of lovely celebration of the fact that they, you know, the parental input into a child's growing up, because it's not just about them getting another year, is it? It's another year that you've had with them, that you've all grown together as a family. But every time people say that, I have this, we didn't. Mm. We didn't. And I think it feeds back into that guilt that I certainly feel, and you know, talking to most, I think, bereaved mothers in particular, but bereaved parents, there is so much guilt because you think, well, yeah, it's so straightforward. You kept them alive, but somehow I couldn't. And you know, I know objectively that's not my fault, but still, somewhere inside you, there's a voice that whispers that maybe it is. Maybe if you'd done something a little bit differently, they would still be here. And I think, you know, people don't mean anything by those comments. I know that now, especially, I think, you know, 2.5 years after he was born and he died, I've had a lot of therapy, I've had a lot of conversations with people, and I think comments that at the beginning would have really kind of slashed me right to the core, I can take a moment to think, okay, you didn't mean it like that, what you meant was this or that or the other. But I do think the more we talk about it, hopefully the more people will pause and think about the things that they say and how that might impact someone, you know, which is, my God, I say the wrong thing in so many situations all the time. We all do, don't we, as human beings. That's part of being a human. But I think, hopefully the more we talk about it, the more people will be able to say things and not feel, you know, not feel so uncomfortable and be able to join in with the conversation and say their names kind of openly and easily. And I don't know whether you find with Willem, but I have definitely found that since talking about Grey and writing the book and, you know, doing the odd interview and things, I notice that people feel less uncomfortable about saying his name. You know, I definitely had a few people early on who sweetly messaged or said things, but kind of would say things like, I'm so sorry about what happened. You know, and you think...
The baby.
Yeah, exactly. And you think, what, my son, Gray, who died? Like, yeah, we can... That's what happened. And I, oh my God, I so understand that, because there are so many things that, you know, death is such an uncomfortable thing, isn't it? Like, I'm not about to pretend that I have some magic bullet of being able to talk about death easily, because I don't. You know, I do think, and I don't know whether you find having, you know, having children and the questions and things that they ask, that I find that sometimes throws you in a bit the deep end with the death questions, because Finn will regularly say things like, you know, well, where is Gray, Mummy? And then you've got to try and work out. And, you know, he thinks that Gray is still in hospital, because neither Mike nor I have offered him a convincing explanation as to where else he might be. And surely that's where he was, because that's where he was born, and he hasn't come home, so he's in hospital. You know, and I think for me, in many ways, his openness about death is very inspiring. You know, he will say, Mummy, Gray is dead and he's not coming back. And he's four, he doesn't really know what that means. But there's something, you know, he looks me straight in the eye when he says it, you know, and he says, it's very sad, he's dead and we are sad. And it, yeah, I find that very inspiring.
It is. I think experiencing a bereavement allows you to have conversations with your children that really encourage you to connect. And I'm really proud of the kind of conversations I've had and the kind of thing we can talk about. I feel like I've signaled to them that there's just nothing we can't talk about.
Yeah.
And actually, I think they grieve quite well. I mean, obviously on a totally different level, but our guinea pigs were killed about 2 months ago. Aww. And obviously for the children, that was really sad. And I literally came down in the morning and saw like guinea pig hair strewn across the lawn, and the fox had got them. And I was like shaking, because I had to tell them, and I just thought, this is going to be awful. And I went upstairs and I woke them up and I said, listen guys, I've got some really sad news, but the guinea pigs are dead. And they were both so sad. I mean, Iona literally lay on the ground howling, banging her head against the carpeted floor, saying, I wish I'd never been born. I was like, wow, this is quite punchy. But what was so lovely is that they properly grieved. They, in that moment, they were with their emotion. They cried and they exhibited everything that they were feeling. And they totally sort of purged their feelings. And we had about an hour of this. And then they went to school and I picked them up from school. And, you know, we were sitting having dinner and my husband Ben was away, and he called them in the evening. And he said, guys, I'm so sorry. And they were like, what about? And it made me realise that they had addressed this really intense feeling that they had, because partly they've grown up in a house where crying and an outpouring of emotion has always been acceptable, actually, if anything, celebrated.
Yeah.
And that really helped them with that sort of grieving process. And me, who was like, I'm keeping it all together because I need to focus on the children, I still feel really teary about the guinea pigs, because I never had this big outward manifestation of the grief and my feelings. But I did think, maybe it's I've just taught them how to grieve really well, or maybe they're just children and they just know how to do it instinctively.
Well, I think it's a bit of both, isn't it? I think I remember having a lot of conversations about that after Gray died, of kind of, you know, Finn was 18 months old at that point, and he had no idea what was going on. He thought the whole thing was a big party, kind of granny and grandpas appearing every 5 seconds, and aunts and uncles, and everyone bringing him presents and lots of attention, and, you know, that was all wonderful. And we were so lucky that he was at an age where he didn't understand what was going on, and we didn't have to have difficult conversations with him at that point. You know, my nephew Sam, who was 5, who came to meet Gray, and, you know, had he, as far as a 5-year-old can, you know, had a understanding of what was going on. And, you know, my sister-in-law and brother had some really complex conversations with him about it and explaining, because, you know, one of the things I think you talk a lot about with death with children is that it often happens at the end of our life and we get old, and then very sadly we die. And when someone younger dies, that's such a difficult thing to explain, isn't it? Well, but they didn't get old, Mummy. No, they didn't, because sometimes, you know, all of those things. But I think one of the things that everyone said to me is, you must let him see you cry. You must let him see you be sad. You must let him feel your emotions, because, you know, children need to learn that you can feel very sad about something and then you are also okay. You know, you can get up and take them to nursery and then you'll feel very sad again. And there will always be times when you feel very sad about this. And actually, you don't get over it. You're not going to get over it. You're always going to be very sad about it, but you will carry that sadness alongside great joy in your life. And I think, I hope that that's a lesson that Finn and eventually Bear, when he's old enough to know about Grey, and, you know, when we'll tell him, I'm sure Finn will tell him, and already does tell him, he has a special sort of Grey voice that he uses and says to Bear, who's, you know, one, has no idea what Finn's saying, kind of, we have another brother, and he is Grey, but he is dead. And, you know, I think that that hopefully will be a special lesson that Grey has kind of given to them somehow, because it's a difficult thing, I think, isn't it? You know, Finn has never grieved Grey. He didn't know him. He was too little. But it is always going to play a role in his life in some way, shape, or form, because he's a huge part of our lives and we're his parents. But I think that, you know, the grieving out loud thing is interesting, isn't it? Because I think it's difficult, particularly possibly being British. I think there is a sense that you control your emotions and, you know, you behave kind of appropriately, whatever that is. I remember my granny saying, when my grandfather died, you know, when I was 18, that the one rule at the funeral was that, you know, none of us should sort of cry, at least not audibly. And I can remember my little cousin sobbing, and I remember looking over him and thinking, oh God, granny's not going to like that. And
weakness.
You think, actually, it's so important. It's so important to release those emotions. It's so important to show our
emotions.
That's
the whole point of a funeral.
Yeah, yeah.
The sole point is to allow everyone to think, this is happening. I've got a good friend whose father died during the pandemic, and they weren't able to have a funeral.
Yeah.
Because the family's all over the world, and it got to sort of 6 months ago, and she was like, we need to have the funeral. And of course, when it's not sort of pending, everyone's like, oh no, there's still difficult things to do, you know, lots of, like, we can't find a date. And she was like, I need to do this. I need to say goodbye to my father in a sort of public way and properly celebrate his life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important. I mean, I think planning Grey's funeral, I definitely found, gave us such purpose after he died. Which sounds so strange, because, I mean, my God, it's just the most bizarre thing you could ever have to do, isn't it? Sitting there and choosing sizes of coffins and working out what you're going to do. And I feel like we definitely went through it slightly on autopilot, because there's so much shock. But we had this amazing female funeral director who was so sensitive and kind and wonderful and kind of guided us through doing, you know, my friend Sam, whose little boy died before he was born and was then stillborn, and I remember her saying to me, it's like a messed up, although she used a slightly stronger word, scavenger hunt, you know, kind of having to complete all these tasks that you're kind of thinking, what, how is this real? And that tiny, tiny coffin, you know, sitting on the catafalque, but it's so important. And his funeral was really beautiful. I remember thinking, like, how am I going to do this? How can you put one foot in front of the other and walk into a room and have a service for your baby, you know, in this coffin that was a wicker, you know, little wicker coffin that was smaller than the Moses basket. But the sun shone through the windows and, yeah, everyone coming together and sharing emotions and celebrating his life, and was such an important part of the process. And actually, I think it was after that I felt a bit kind of unleashed into the world, because especially with Grey, we'd had these 3 weeks in the NICU that was so regimented, and, you know, times that you would do everything, and I was pumping while he was in the NICU, and I found after his funeral I couldn't stop. I think I'd kind of still needed that regimented kind of control over my days of something happening. And I don't know whether it was partly that, you know, a connection to him, partly kind of having some control, I think, because you, with a newborn, your day is so full of them, isn't it? And then you don't have a newborn and your day is full of nothing. All this space that you, I think sometimes you didn't even realise you had made for this person coming in, and then you have these days that are just empty and you're sitting there thinking, what do I do? How do we do this? I remember Mike and I sitting at our kitchen table and saying, how do we do this? How do we pretend? Do we pretend to Finn that we're happy? How do we get through kind of life forever now? How do his first birthday will roll around and then his fifth, and this year Willem's eighth. Like, one day that it'll be their 18th, their 21st, their 30th. I hope we live that long. And then now I look back and I think, we don't have to pretend. I'm really happy. And that doesn't mean that some days aren't hideous. And as we were talking a bit about earlier, sometimes moments creep up on you. And sometimes I think days that you thought were going to be really hard actually end up being easier. And I had a moment, the night before Finn and Bear both had their birthday last week, and their birthday's on the same day. And the night before, just a moment thinking, he should be here. Kind of joking and laughing about the fact that he gets to have his own birthday and they have to share. And it was really hard and sad. And then that's bound up into then feeling how lucky that I have them. And it's confusing, isn't it? Because I think that can then bring about guilt. I sometimes find, when I find things hard, inevitably about parenting, I have a little voice somewhere in my head saying, you shouldn't find this hard. You've done really the hardest thing hopefully you'll ever have to do. This should be easy. But those things are still hard. The first time we did bath time with Finn and Bear, I sobbed afterwards to Mike, and it was partly that I was sobbing because I was exhausted and it had been really hard, and partly because I felt so bad that I found it hard, because I thought I've spent so long dreaming of putting two boys in the bath and washing them together, and then it's come and I'm exhausted and I can't do it, and this one's crying and he needs feeding and that one needs a story read to him, and it's, yeah, it kind of feeds into everything really, doesn't it? I think the grief, the love, their position in your life and how you frame them in your life, I think.
What do you do on Gray's birthday?
So we, for the last 2 years, we have had a little party with a cake and blown out candles. And the year before, so for his first birthday, we bought Finn a little present. And then last year, when it was the first year that Bear was here too, they gave each other little presents just on his birthday, because we thought, rather than each year kind of giving them a present on their birthday from Grey, he'd do it on his birthday. And actually, I find his birthday really joyful. Obviously, I think sounds funny to say, but I feel quite lucky that we have his birthday and his death day as separate days, because obviously I know for you and for anyone whose baby dies before they're born, those days are combined, which must add such a layer of confusion to it. What do you guys do for Willem's birthday?
We've never had a cake, but we do refer to it as his birthday as opposed to his death day.
Yeah.
And we usually, I just sort of do like my favourite, what I want to do.
Yeah.
I'm really indulgent on that day.
Yeah.
I think I want to surround myself with my favourite people and do really nice things.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's a reflection on, how lucky we are, which I know sounds a bit kind of contrived, but I do feel that it was so sad that he didn't live.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
But he does have this amazing legacy that he sort of taught us so much about life and love and friendship and this kind of idea of post-traumatic growth. I feel like I'm a better mother and a better wife and a better friend because I experienced that trauma of having lost a child. And so while he's not here and while he didn't even get to make a sound outside the uterus, like, he has this amazing legacy, and that's sort of what we celebrate. And that's kind of why I get annoyed when, you know, there's this like danger of him getting forgotten, because he had such a profound impact on us as a family and beyond that as well. That I just, like, it's a day to make him really relevant and celebrate that sort of who he was.
Yeah, 100%. I completely agree. I think it's funny, isn't it? Because with the whole thing of asking how many children you have, when I think of my children, I think of all three of them. Like, their little faces pop into my head together. And the effect, you know, I think all of your children have a huge impact on your life, don't they? But the effect that he has had and the impact on my life and the things that I have taught, that he has taught me, is just absolutely enormous. And I completely agree with you. I feel like he has made me a better mother. I sometimes worry that he has made me, in some short term, a bit worse friend, because I think for the last few years I have probably been more kind of self-involved is the wrong thing, but, you know, I think I've had to focus on myself and Mike and our family maybe more so than naturally feels comfortable, because I want to be there for friends and things that I haven't necessarily been able to be. But the sense of perspective that his life and death has brought to me is just amazing, really, is which as you say, it feels so confusing, doesn't it? Because you think, on the one hand, I would much rather that he was just here and, you know, kind of cheeky, naughty 2.5-year-old running around. But this legacy and presence he has in my life is kind of so much bigger. You know, he feels, I think, sometimes like a kind of little wise old man who sort of sits on my shoulder and comes around to places with me and, you know, does sometimes kind of tap me and remind me, like, this doesn't matter, don't get stressed about this. Sometimes I get stressed about it anyway, but I think, I sometimes miss the kind of clarity of the immediate aftermath of his life and death, which sounds so strange because, my God, you know, in many ways those days were so hard and so heartbreaking. But I feel like I knew so clearly what really mattered, and I definitely forget sometimes now and worry and stress about tiny things, but inevitably I think he does bring me back to kind of, you know.
But by writing the book and talking openly about Grey, you're essentially telling your friends that, you know, you can have whatever conversation they need to have. And I definitely find, and it continues, you know, happened again a couple of weeks ago, that rubbish things happen to people and we feel that we need to keep them close. And they can tell you.
Yeah.
And you can give them permission to talk about it, to acknowledge what they're feeling. And most of the time all I do is listen.
Yeah.
But the fact that people feel that they can tell me about the really rubbish stuff that's happening to them, you know, I think that does make you a better friend. It makes you,
we
probably all could do with fewer friends but more intense connections.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what has been achieved.
Definitely. And I think as well, there's something really refreshing, isn't there, about being able to, you know, with friends, and also I think sometimes with, you know, people you meet, being able to cut kind of small talk. I've never been very good at small talk anyway, and actually sometimes when you say kind of, oh yeah, I did have another son and he was born and he died, you can't really then kind of chat about the weather or something kind of innocuous, do you? You end up having slightly bigger conversations about kind of life or, you know, parenting or, you know, connections to people or friendships or, I don't know, which is quite refreshing in many ways, isn't it? To not have to sort of talk around subjects, but to talk about kind of life, really, and what that means.
I always felt so guilty about, you know, teaching antenatal classes that I was like the sort of horror story that no one really ever wants to think about, and here I was teaching their classes, but I was like, I can't introduce myself to people and not tell them about possibly the most pivotal, you know, happening of my life. I mean, that just feels so insincere. But so I do. I always, when I introduce myself, I've got Ludo and Iona, but I also have Willem.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how just that acknowledgement gives people permission to acknowledge that their lives aren't perfect. And it's so interesting because we go and go around the room and people introduce themselves to us. And the amount of times people are like, you know, I have had 7 years of IVF to get here, or I've had miscarriages, or I'm not even sure I want this baby. And, you know, to acknowledge all the kind of feelings and, you know, problems in marriage or relationships. And actually, I do think that helps us so much as people. I'm not saying necessarily to the whole world, but amongst a small group of people who you kind of only just met, but you're going to rely on massively, to sort of start that relationship off with, I'm vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, my social media might not suggest this, but I can also have tough time. Yeah. I think it's an amazing way to start a relationship.
I completely agree. I think it's such an important thing, and it does create deeper bonds. I think, you know, as you say, with social media and things, we're possibly not very good as a society at acknowledging the kind of bad stuff that happens, and everyone wants to paint a glossy veneer over everything, and life's not really like that, is it? And actually, I think lots of the real magic and like the deep love comes from the toughest moments. You know, I often think that about Mike and I, and, you know, my God, there have been times, and I'm sure will continue to be times, where we're on a different page, and we process it, Gray's death differently, we've felt differently about all sorts of things. But actually, you know, I remember thinking when we were sitting in the room and Gray was being given his diagnosis, kind of, I thought that real true love was like the kind of walking down the aisle and in the pretty dress, and, you know, I didn't really, obviously I knew it was a lifetime of marriage, but, you know, lots of, you think kind of the fairy tale is the beautiful moments, and actually I thought, no, this, like, watching you hear this news about our son, this is true love, because I wish I could save you from this even more than myself, and I can't. But I also know that we're going to walk through this together. We'll probably fight at different times. And, you know, I actually remember my friend Sam, whose son died, saying that, I remember going to see her afterwards and saying, how are you doing? And she said, oh, we had a fight this morning. My God, it was such a relief, because we've just been being so bloody nice to each other for the last few weeks. And it was such a relief to have a bit of normality. And, you know, so you do, it doesn't kind of suddenly gold plate a relationship, does it? But it, I think, you know, walking through a furnace together and coming out the other side definitely taught me a lot about love and how, you know, how things look versus how they actually are, and what really matters in relationships, I think.
All right. I mean, you know, our partner's often so little comparatively by the time we either get married or have children. And I remember thinking, you know, I loved Ben because he was fun and good looking and we had a great time together. And then you realise, you go through that and you're like, God, I'm married to a rock, you know, someone that will get through this.
Yeah.
And I definitely found it was that sort of sink or swim moment.
Yeah.
But I couldn't have swum without him. No way.
Yeah, totally. I remember my dad saying, actually, he said, this is a funny thing to say, but in some ways I envy you and Mike. And I sort of said, why? And he said, well, you know, because you've walked together through probably the fieriest furnace that life can throw at you. And you've walked through it together. And, you know, he was like, I'm not about to imagine that the furnace is kind of over. But, you know, he's like, that's quite an amazing thing to have done in many ways. You know, because I know that sounds funny, but I know what he means exactly as you say. Like, this, you know, Mike's funny and good looking and great, and we have a really fun time. And then actually, yeah, he was a rock. He held me together, held our families together. I felt like I just kind of wandered through the days that Gray was in NICU and kind of was, you know, didn't know what was going on. He was the one updating people and contacting friends. And yeah, I remember sitting with the funeral director and her saying, you know, I'm going to address my questions to Mike, because I do tend to find that, you know, possibly the partner is the one who's in charge. And kind of Mike was sitting there, you know, with this folder and a pen, and I had this kind of grubby tissue paper and a bit of tissue in my hand. I was kind of, you know, I'm thinking, yeah, he's definitely the one that is holding all of this together. And then I think, you know, that interesting thing that I know Tommy's have obviously done a lot of work around is that then I was the one who had a lot of the kind of, you know, I say attention, it was not just, you know, a lot of the support more outwardly was very focused on me and whether I was okay. And, you know, actually, I still think now, like, it was Mike that was kind of shouldering the brunt of so much stuff. You know, when Gray was in hospital, I found I couldn't, they do a ward round where they talk through kind of different aspects of the baby's care, and I found sometimes I just couldn't be in it. I couldn't, you know, I wanted to know, but I just found I'd sit there and I'd be second guessing what their faces meant, and when they were talking about this or that, the other, did that actually mean that, or were they really saying this? You know, so he'd do all of those and feed it back to me and everything. He was running it all, and then I was kind of, you know, would be sitting on the sofa at home because I was on mat leave and he was having to go back to work. And it's phenomenal. And just thinking about that, I think I've never properly kind of thanked him, you know, for holding us together. Because he did.
There's a combination, you know. I'm sure if he was here, he'd say you held him together. Uh-huh. And I think often there's lots of different roles.
Mm, there certainly are, aren't there?
I want to talk a bit about Bear and about your pregnancy after Gray was born and after he died, and how that was, because I think very often people think, oh, I'll have another baby and it will make everything better. But I also know that it is often so affected by the trauma of what you've experienced, you know, A, the worry that it will happen again.
Yeah.
But also that reality that it doesn't replace your child, that it doesn't make it all better at all. And sometimes it can, you know, you can struggle and feel very guilty, as you acknowledged. You know, this idea is, you know, bath time with two boys is all I wanted and I can't even do that. Mm. How was that for you?
So I had a C-section with Gray. I've had C-sections with all of the deliveries. And so I remember actually driving back to London from, because Gray was born and lived in Kent, and I think it was about 2 weeks after he had died, and I remember saying to Mike, we need to have another baby, I need to have another baby. And I think Mike was kind of thinking, what are you talking about? I think I felt like this kind of, this instinct inside me that I needed to have another baby, and we'd been told it would really not be sensible or safe to kind of try and have another baby for probably around about a year after I'd had the C-section, so I couldn't. And I think, you know, I did in that moment feel like I wanted to do whatever anyone medical told me to do, because I was terrified of happening again. And I remember then when we were kind of told, you know, okay, that's, you know, probably enough time has passed and you can try, and then thinking, oh God, actually, wait a second, can I even do this? You know, when it was that kind of 2 weeks afterwards, and I, you know, obviously all subconsciously, it wasn't an option then. And now that it is, how do you do this? And I was very, very, very lucky and got pregnant relatively easily, which we weren't sure that was going to be the case, but I did. And initially I remember feeling really excited, and then as I went through the pregnancy, just these anxieties crept in. And I always think we didn't tell anyone that I was pregnant except people we saw and our immediate family, because one of the things I couldn't deal with was other people's reactions to it and people saying, oh my God, this is so exciting, and seeing in their face how I felt I should feel, but I didn't. I don't know whether subconsciously I thought, if I don't get excited about this, if the same thing happens again, I'll somehow protect myself, I'll somehow, you know, if this baby dies too, I'll feel less sad. I don't know what it was, but I couldn't feel excited. And I think one of the things I found was that, you know, there is this phenomenally amazing community of people that I was lucky to kind of find my way into through Instagram, who have lost babies and lost children. But one of the difficult things is that, alongside knowing how Grey died, there are hundreds of other ways that I knew how babies could die. And it suddenly became to me much more likely that this baby would die. Even if they didn't die the same way that Grey died, there would be something else that would kill them, definitely, because that was just far more likely than them being born well. I had amazing support. I had a therapist, a bereavement therapy, which I know is not, I had on the NHS, which I know is, you know, not at all universal and really should be. And so I was seeing her through my pregnancy, and I also had a caseloading midwife who saw only me, and who I only saw her. And it was really hard. And we, with Finn and Grey, we found out, we didn't find out what we were having, we had surprises. With Bear, I felt that I needed to, because I couldn't deal with there being any surprises. I didn't. And I didn't want people saying, oh, I wonder what you're having, because I was just thinking, well, I wonder whether I'll get to bring this baby home. And I think also after Grey was born and died, I spent quite a lot of time wishing I'd known he was a boy, which I know that, you know, gender is totally just a construct, and I know it shouldn't work like that, but I felt like if I'd known he was a boy, I would have somehow had a kind of closer relation, you know, I would have known him. And then we found out that Bear was a boy, and I remember thinking, oh, but I don't know him. And actually the complicated thing is that my brain is kind of thinking that this is Grey again, but maybe this time I'll get a chance for him to kind of be okay. And it was kind of complicated by the fact that Finn knew I was pregnant and knew it was a boy and thought it was Grey as well, and kept saying, it's Grey in Mummy's tummy. And Mike and I would say, no, it's actually not, it's a different baby. And then Finn would say, well, what's his name then? And we'd say, well, he doesn't have a name. So then Finn was obviously thinking, well, I mean, it's Grey, isn't it? Because Grey does have a name, and you've got a baby boy in your tummy, you're both a bit mad. And I think I kept waiting for a moment when I would feel that it would be okay. And Grey was born at 31 weeks, and I got to 31 weeks. I actually had a horrible labour scare at 31 weeks, and ended up in hospital. And it was fine. They did a test, and I wasn't going into labour, but it was all kind of quite, you know, big flashback. But I remember thinking, if I get past that, maybe I'll feel better. But Grey wasn't diagnosed with his chromosome disorder until 2 weeks after he was born. So actually, I didn't feel safe then. And then I remember thinking, oh, I'll have this moment when they do the C-section and then they give him to me and everything will be okay. And I had to be in hospital for a bit before he was born, and which was actually quite nice in the end, apart from the fact that because of COVID, Finn couldn't come and see me. But kind of being checked and tested. I didn't really trust my body. And actually it was those 10 days before he was born where I was in hospital and I was having, you know, he was checked twice a day and I was checked and all these things were checked. I could kind of, it wasn't my responsibility to check that this baby was okay. It was kind of someone else's, which felt really kind of like a relief at that point. And then he was born. And I think the first night was complicated and felt very strange. And we were really lucky because Grey was born outside London. We weren't in the hospital where Grey had been born, which I think was phenomenally lucky, because I've spoken to friends who have to go back to the same hospital and, you know, all those triggers, which must just be so confusing. And, you know, rooms where you've been given bad news and and we didn't have any of that. But there still were so many layers of complexity, and I think I still didn't trust when he came home that there wasn't something wrong, and kept kind of looking at him. And you know, when newborns are first there, they can't give very much back to you. They can't tell you that they're okay. They can't smile at you. They can't. And
they're all a bit weird.
Yeah.
Let's face it. They all do odd things.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was very confusing. I felt so, you know, on the one hand, so lucky to have this tiny thing, and I loved him so much, but it did dig up a lot of very complicated emotions. And I think, you know, in the 9 months to a year after Grey had died, before I got pregnant, I felt like I had, as far as maybe you can in that time frame, I felt like I got to a good place. Like, that sounds funny, but you know, I had a real sense of inner peace in many ways. And I think, you know, obviously the pandemic was horrific, but I think lockdown we were kind of forced to sit with our emotions a bit. And Finn was with me and Mike was with me, and we were actually really lucky at my parents' house. And kind of, so lots of people who are incredibly important to me are very close to me, and they weren't out of my sight, and I knew that they were safe. And then I had this space to kind of process, you know, it's a bad word, isn't it? You can never process it, but to sit with it. And then suddenly I was pregnant again, and I felt like it just catapulted me in many ways straight back to kind of very early grief days, but without the shock that comes with those early days. And it was really complicated, and I remember talking to my therapist about it, and she was kind of saying, in many ways, you're going to grieve Grey kind of from the beginning all over again, because at some point your mind needs to accept that this baby is not Grey, it's another baby, and that's amazing and wonderful, but you can't, you know, I think you probably go through those bargains, don't you, of, can I, you know, how can I kind of bring him back, how, this is another little boy, and it was really complicated. And then I think in the early days, as I was saying, a lot of that guilt around kind of feeling like I wasn't doing it very well in certain bits, or I, like, Bear was quite little when he was born as well, which was quite complicated, because Finn was, you know, bang on average, whereas Bear was quite small, and so he looked in many ways much more like Grey. He was quite a skinny little baby. Finn had been like a bit of a chubber. And that kind of played with my mind, because I was like, why is he small? Something must be wrong. And a NICU doctor came to check him over, which we'd all agreed, you know, was going to happen because of everything that had gone before. And they said he was fine, everything was fine, but I just didn't quite believe it, I think. So yeah, and then I think parenting after loss is very complicated as well, isn't it? You suddenly, I think I've definitely had moments where I've really had to talk to myself about letting Finn especially, and I'm sure, you know, Bear as he grows up, do things, because I kind of want to wrap him up in cotton wool and keep him at home with me. And it's really hard to override that instinct to think, like, you just stay here with me and don't climb that big climbing frame and don't go up there and don't do this, because what if something happens to you? And I know that all parents have that, and I know, you know, I've never been an anxiety-free person. You know, I've always worried a bit about those things, but I think somehow when you've held your dead child in your arms and you know how that feels, you can imagine so clearly how that might feel if it was one of your other children. And it's really difficult to override those thoughts, isn't it? And to let them do things that feel dangerous.
It's so hard, that catastrophization. And I went on a run, this is a couple of years ago, and I left the children alone at home by themselves for like the first time. I've like literally gone for half an hour.
Yeah.
And throughout the run, all I thought about was all the terrible things that could happen while I was gone. And I imagined that maybe Ludo, I think it was just Ludo at home, and he's a really sensible child.
Yeah.
I was like, what if he's in the garden and he's stung in the throat by a bee and he suffocates and I find him dead in the garden? That's what I was thinking in my run. And I was like, Marina, if you were with a friend and all that friend was basically telling you what your brain was telling you, that, you know, what if, I'd be like, shut up.
Yeah.
Why are you torturing me like this.
Yeah.
But there's this idea that there's a part of your brain that is just really mean.
Yeah.
There's,
yeah.
I don't know if you've ever listened to, there's an amazing guy called Mo Gaudat who's a sort of...
Oh my God, I love
him. Isn't he great? Mm. And he has a name for that part of his brain. He's given her a female name.
It?
And he's like, she's called like Rebecca or something.
Yeah.
And he's like, just shut up. And once you think about that sort of internal voice as a person...
Yeah, because he talks about how it's not you, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's not you, it's, you know...
Yeah, it's just your brain playing tricks on you. And very often that kind of inner voice is so mean and horrid and unhelpful. And he's like, by giving her an identity, I can tell her to shut up.
Yeah.
And it really struck me that it's exactly that.
But
I think everyone who... Yeah, I mean, we all experience that.
Yeah. Very confusing and difficult. But
and did you ever get any comments of like, oh, you've now got your two boys, all's well now, all's well that ends well?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a sense, and I remember my friend Sam talking about this with her son, and then when her daughter was born, that she felt like some people kind of breathed a sigh of relief of sort of, oh, maybe we can stop talking about the dead one now. And I definitely feel like, you know, I can't think of any sort of specific comments that anyone has made, but definitely there were a few, and a couple of sort of, you know, I know very, very well-meaning cards and things that sort of said, like, what joy after such trauma. And you know, yes, on the one hand, my God, we are so lucky to have him. And I always think about that Rob Delaney thing of, you know, that he thought after his little boy Henry died, he didn't love his other children more, but he loved them better. And that knowledge that they're kind of, I think he talks about these little kind of bundles of stardust, that it's your, this amazing privilege to hold them. And I feel that so strongly. And every milestone that Bear hits somehow has this added magic, because Grey never got to do that. And I feel so phenomenally lucky. But equally, it's not fair on Bear or fair on Grey to kind of meld them together. And I think that's one of the other things I find complicated about kind of some, you know, people, obviously there's all sorts of things, aren't there, that we just, you know, people say number two about the second child, and people say like, oh, and this is number two, and I think, no, he's number three, he came third, I was pregnant three, you know, apart from anything else, my body knows very well that it has been pregnant three times, you know, and it's not fair on either of them, I don't think, to kind of combine them together into this, like, he's the joy that came after the awfulness. It's actually one of the reasons why I totally, totally get the term rainbow baby. And I think, you know, many people, it resonates really strongly with them. And I think you have to use whatever works for you. For me, I don't think of him, you know, I know that technically, and actually I think the NHS use it as a rainbow pregnancy, so they know kind of you need extra care and support and things. But as a concept... Yeah, it doesn't.
It's a nicer name than parent of dead baby or bereaved parent.
Yes,
or...
exactly. Yeah. But I don't think of Bear like that, mostly because, you know, and I've heard other people talk about the same, that I don't see Grey as a storm, that then, you know, the sun came out with Bear. And in many ways, you know, life's not that simple, is it? It's not kind of this is all sad and then this is all happy, because there was a lot of joy with Grey. There still is a lot of joy with Grey. And then there's... Yeah, there are complex emotions with Bear, and I don't, you know, I think someone, actually a colleague of Mike's, I remember saying to him, oh, you got your happy ending. And I remember Mike saying, A, he's not an ending, he's a beginning, he's his own beginning, totally separate. And also, life, you know, we don't get to package life up into boxes like that, or you tie a big bow on it and say kind of there's your happy ending.
It's not a rom-com.
No, exactly.
But we're so conditioned to believe that there is a happy ending. Every book we read, every, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a fiction.
Exactly. And I think it's interesting with the book, because I really wanted to not... You know, Bear's mentioned in the acknowledgements, but I kind of wanted, really importantly, him to not be in the story, because I feel like lots of the joy and some of the kind of peace I found after Grey died was about him and my relationship with him. And it wasn't, you know, I was phenomenally lucky to have Finn, and, you know, just in terms of the fact I had to get up in the morning and take him to nursery, and he put a structure into my day that was really valuable, and because he's a wonderful little boy. But all the boys are separate. You know, there's Finn, and there's the amazingness of him, and there's Grey and the amazingness of him, and Bear and the amazingness of him. And obviously they all feed into each other, and, you know, you can't separate out your children like that in some ways. But in other ways, it's really important to, I think, isn't it? They are their own people, whether they're alive or not alive. They occupy their own space in your heart, in your mind. And I think drawing those distinctions is important.
I think you're absolutely right. It's so lovely chatting to you. And I've got to say, for those of you listening, I think you can tell that this book is amazing. It really is such a beautifully written book, you know, and I think relevant for people who've lost babies and haven't lost babies and are just curious about people and humankind. And it's an extraordinary story. I know we haven't talked in great detail about what actually happened, because that is conveyed so beautifully in the book. So I'm kind of glad we haven't, because I'll leave the book to you know, tell you about Grey's story. But it's amazing. I highly recommend it. I literally tore through it at a rate of knots, and it had me laughing and crying, and it was just wonderful. So
thank you
so much for writing it. It's brave and such an important book. So thank you. And thank you so much for coming to chat. It's lovely to have a face-to-face chat after so long, kind of
it's
remote.
It's been so lovely. Thank you. I feel like we could kind of carry on chatting for hours. Give people a sort of 12-hour podcast. Might be a bit much. But no, it's been so, so lovely to chat to you too. And I mean, you know, as we've said, there is this amazing connection, I think, I certainly feel with people who have... You know, though of course our stories are different, everyone's stories always are, but I think some of the same emotions and feelings, and ultimately that, you know, someone vitally important missing, one of your children, I think does forge this kind of bond. So it's been really wonderful to speak to you. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I remember you saying that The Parenthood was one of the first things that you listened to.
It was. After. The conversation with, was it Jen from Teddy's Wish and Julia Samuel, I remember I was driving along this road, and actually whenever I drive along that road I think about that podcast, because I remember listening to it. A friend of mine listened to it, she said, kind of searching for something to kind of say, and then said to me, kind of, when you feel ready to listen to something, maybe listen to this. And I think it was a January after he died, and because I had to have an operation after he died, and I remember driving to, I think I was going to physio, and thought, oh, we've got, you know, an hour drive, I'll listen to that. And it was just, it sounds crazy, doesn't it, because you think, I don't want anyone to know how this feels, and then it's also so comforting to hear people speak about things, and you think, oh yes, that's how I feel, that's, you're talking to me, and I'm not alone in these feelings, I'm not going mad, because I think you sometimes feel as though you are. And so it was just, remember it so clearly, and it was so important, such an important thing for me. Thank you for that.
Well, it's so lovely to hear, because obviously I record these, and then I know, because I do get lots of feedback, but it's just really lovely to hear when it's been helpful. But Georgina, thank you so much. Georgina's book, If Not For You, is available on Amazon. It's also the most beautiful book. Like, the cover is just so gorgeous.
They did so well with the cover.
Really,
it's
really
lovely,
well.
Isn't it?
Well, I highly recommend it. Thank you for joining me today. And thank you all for downloading this episode of The Parenthood. You can subscribe, rate and review wherever you found this podcast. You can also follow me. I'm at marina.fogel. But in the meantime, from Georgina and me, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.